Chapter 8. Somewhere a bell was tolling. Muted at first by distance, it rapidly grew in volume. Clang, clang, it went. Strange, I thought, a bell? Good gracious, it's tolling in time with my heartbeat. For a moment, panic threatened to overwhelm me. Had I overslept and been late for temple service? Blearily, I opened my eyes and tried to see where I was. This was strange. I couldn't focus. All I could discern was 9 horrible white blobs stuck on the top of saffron streaks. My brain creaked with the effort of thought. Where was I? What happened? Had I fallen off a roof or something? Drearily, I became aware that there were various aches and pains surging back into my consciousness. Oh, yes. It all came back with a rush, and with the knowledge came the ability to focus my eyes and see what was before me. I was lying on my back on the stone-cold floor. My bowl had somehow slipped from front to back in my robe and was now supporting my weight between my shoulder blades. My barley bag of hard leather had worked down and was almost breaking my left ribs. Touchily, I moved and stared up at the 9 lamas sitting watching me. They were the horrible white blobs stuck on saffron streaks. I hoped that they did not know what I had thought. "Yes, love sang, we do know," smiled one. "Your telepathic thoughts were very clear on the subject. But rise slowly. You've done well and fully justified your guide's remarks." Gingerly, I sat up, receiving a hearty butt in the back and a roaring purr as I did so. The old cat came round to face me and touched my hand as a sign that he wanted his fur ruffled. Idly, I did so as I collected my scattered wits and wondered what would happen next. "Well, love sang, that was a good experience of getting out of the body," said the lama who had accompanied me. "We must try it often, so that you can get out of your body as easily as shrugging off your robe." "But, honorable lama," I said in some confusion, "I did not leave my body. I took it with me." The lama guide's jaw dropped in astonishment. "What do you mean?" he exclaimed. "You traveled in spirit with me." "Honorable lama," was my rejoinder, "I looked specially, and my body was not on the floor, so I must have taken it with me." The old wizened lama, the smallest of the 9, smiled and said, "You're making a common mistake, love saying, for you are still bemused by the senses." I looked at him, and quite honestly, I did not know what he was talking about. It seemed to me that he had taken leave of his senses, for, I thought, surely I should know if I saw my own body or not, and if I did not see my body, then it must not have been there. I suppose they must have seen by my skeptical glance that I was not taking in what they were saying, what they were implying, because one of the other lamas motioned for me to pay attention. "I'm going to give you my version of it, Lobsang," said this other lama, "and I want you to pay close attention, for what I have to say is elementary, yet it is a matter which puzzles a lot of people. You were lying on the floor, And as this was your first conscious time of astral traveling, we helped you. We helped ease your astral form out of your physical form. And because it was done by us, who have a lifetime of experience, you did not feel any jolt or any disturbance. Wherefore it is clear that you had no idea that you were out of the body. I looked at him and thought about it. I thought, yes, that's right, I had no idea that I was out of the body. No one had said I was going to be out of the body, so if they hadn't told me what to expect, how could I have a feeling of leaving the body? But then, it all came back to me that I had looked down and I had not seen my body lying on the floor as surely as I should have done unless I was still in my body. I shook my head as if to shake the cobwebs loose. I felt that all this was getting too deep for me. I was out of the body, yet my body wasn't there. So, if it wasn't there, where was it? And why hadn't I seen it lying about somewhere? Just then, the old cat gave me another butt and started knitting and kneading, bumping up and down on my lap, sinking his claws into my robe, and purring louder and louder, reminding me that I must stay aware of his presence also. The lama, who had been speaking, laughed as he remarked, "There, old cat is telling you to scrape your brains clear so that you may perceive." I spread my fingers and raked the cat's back. His purrs increased in volume. Then suddenly he just flopped down at length. He was a big old thing. His head was sticking over one side of my lap, and his legs were protruding over the other side, with his tail stretched straight out on the floor. These cats grew larger than the average sort of cat. They were normally fierce, but our temple cats all seemed to recognize me as a brother or something, because, certainly, I was as popular with them as they were with me. The lama, who had been speaking to me before, turned to me saying, "Leave him be. He can rest on you while we talk to you. Perhaps he'll give you a good dig every so often to remind you to pay attention." Now, people see what they expect to see. Often they do not see that which is most obvious. For instance, he looked hard at me as he said this, "How many cleaners were there in the corridor as you came along? Who was that man sweeping in the barley store? And if the Lord Abbot had sent for you and asked you to tell him if you'd seen anyone in the inner corridor, what would you have told him?" He paused for a moment to see if I was going to make any remark, and as I just stared at him, open-mouthed, I'm afraid, he continued, "You would have said you saw no one in the corridor because the person who was in the inner corridor was a person who has every right to be there, who is always there, and who would be so correct in that corridor that you would not even notice him. So you'd say you saw no one in that corridor." Another lama broke in, nodding his head wisely as he added his piece. "The proctors often have some difficulty when they're carrying out an investigation. They may ask us if there were any strangers, or if anyone had been in a certain building, and invariably a custodian of the building would say, 'No, no one had been in.' And yet there might have been a procession of people. There would have been proctors passing by. There would have been perhaps a lama or two, and there might even be a messenger from another lamasery. But because these people were so common, that is, because it's so usual for them to be in the vicinity, their passage would be unnoticed, and as far as being observed, they might just as well have been invisible. One who had not yet spoken nodded his head. "Yes, that is so. Now I ask you, Lobsang, how many times have you been in this temple? And yet, by your look, quite recently you had not seen the stand upon which we rested the crystal. That stand has been here for about 200 years. It has not been out of this temple, and yet you looked at it as if you were seeing it for the first time. It was here before, but it was commonplace to you, therefore it was invisible." The Lama, who had been with me on my astral trip through the Potala, smiled as he continued, "You, Lobsang, had no idea of what was happening. You did not know you were going to be out of the body. Therefore, you were not prepared to see your body. Thus, when you looked at lamas sitting in a circle, and your attention carefully avoided your own body. We get the same thing in hypnotism. We can hypnotize a person to believe that he's completely alone in a room, and then that person in a state of hypnosis will look everywhere in a room except at the person who shares the room with him. And the hypnotized person, on being awakened, would take an oath to the effect that he had been alone. Well, in the same way, you carefully avoided looking at where your body was in plain view. Instead, you looked around the perimeter of the circle. You looked around the temple, avoiding the one spot that you thought you wanted to see." It really made me think. I had heard something like that before. I had once seen an old monk who had had a bad attack of migraine. As he explained it to me afterwards, things at which he looked were not there. If he looked at a thing in front of him, he could only see things at the side. But if he looked towards the side, he could see things in front of him. He told me it was like looking through a pair of tubes placed over the eyes, so that in effect he was as one wearing blinkers. A lama, I did not know one from the other then, said, "The obvious often might be invisible, because the more common an object, the more familiar an object, the less noticeable it becomes. Take the man who brings barley. You see him every day, and yet you do not see him. He's such a familiar figure that had I asked you who came along here this morning, you would say no one, because you would not regard the barley carrier as a person, but just as something that always did a certain thing at a specified time. It seemed most remarkable to me that I should be lying on the ground, but then be unable to see my own body. However, I had heard so much about hypnotism and astral traveling that I was quite able to accept their explanation." The old wizened lama smiled at me as he remarked, "We shall soon have to give you more specific instruction, so that you can leave your body easily at any time. Like everyone else, you have been doing astral traveling every night. traveling off to distant places and then forgetting about it, but we want to show you how easy it is for you to get out of your body at any time at all and go on to an astral journey and then return to your body, retaining the full knowledge of all that you've seen and all that you have done. If you can do that, you can travel to the great cities of the world, and you will not be isolated here in Tibet, but can acquire a knowledge of all cultures. I thought about that. I had wondered often how some of our higher lamas seem to have all knowledge. They seem to be beings apart, being remote from the pettiness of everyday life, being able to say what was happening at any moment in any part of our country. I remembered on one occasion I, with my guide, had called upon an old man. I had been presented to him, and we had been talking, or rather my guide and he had been talking, and I had been respectfully listening. Suddenly, the old man had held up his hands, saying, "I am called." Then he had withdrawn. The light seemed to go out from his body. He sat there immobile, looking like a dead man, looking like an empty shell. My guide sat quite still and motioned for me also to be still and quiet. We sat together with our hands clasped in our laps. We sat there without speaking, without moving. I watched what appeared to be the empty figure with vast interest. For perhaps 10, maybe 20 minutes, it was difficult to gauge time under those circumstances, and nothing happened. Then there was the color of animation returning to the old man. Eventually he stirred and opened his eyes, and then, I shall never forget it, he told my guide exactly what was happening at Shigatse, which was quite some way from us. It occurred to me that this was far better as a system of communication than all the remarkable devices I had heard of in the outside world. I wanted to be able to astral travel anywhere. I wanted to be able to move across the mountains and across the seas and into foreign lands. And these men, these 9 lamas, were going to teach me. The old cat yawned, making his whiskers vibrate, and then he stood up and stretched until I almost thought he'd break in two. Then he strolled off, arrogantly pushing his way between 2 lamas, and disappeared into the darkness behind one of the sacred figures. The old, wizened lama spoke, saying, "Well, it is time we brought this session to an end, for we did not come here to teach Lobsang on this occasion. This is just an incidental. We must set about our other work, and we will see Lobsang again when his guide returns." Another one turned to me and gave me a hard stare. "You will have to learn very carefully, Lobsang. You will have a lot to do in life. You will have hardships, suffering, and you will travel far and often. But in the end, you will achieve that which is your task. We will give you the basic training." They rose to their feet, picked up the crystal, leaving the stand, and left the temple. I sat wondering. A task, hardship. But I'd always been told I'd had a hard life ahead of me. Always been told that I had a task. So why did they rub it in so? Anyhow, why did I have to do the task? Why was I always the one to have suffering? The more I heard about it, the less I liked it. But I did want to travel in the astral and see all the things I had heard about. Gingerly, I climbed to my feet, wincing and muttering unkind words as the pain shot through my legs again. Pins and needles, and then a few bumps and bruises where I had fallen down a few times, and a pain between my shoulder blades where I had been resting upon my bowl. Thinking of that, I reached inside my robe and sorted my possessions into their accustomed position. Then, with a final look around, I left the temple. At the door, I hastily turned and went back to the flickering butter lamps. One by one, I snuffed them out, for that was my duty. I was the last one to leave, therefore I was the one to snuff out the lamps. As I felt my way through the darkness to where there was a faint glimmer from the open door, my nostrils were assailed by the stench of smoldering wicks. Somewhere off in a corner, there was the dying red ember of a wick, which was just then charring into blackness. I stood for a moment at the door, deciding which way I would go. Then, with my mind made up, I turned and made my way to the right. The bright starlight was pouring in through the windows, imparting a silvery blue appearance to everything. I turned a corner into the corridor and stopped suddenly, thinking, yes, of course, they were right. I stood there for a moment and thought. It occurred to me that time after time I had passed an old monk sitting in a little cell, and yet, although I saw him every day, I had never even noticed him. I retraced my steps for perhaps 10 yards and peered in. There he was, in a little stone cell on the far side of the corridor, opposite the windows. He was blind. Endlessly he sat there on the floor, turning a prayer wheel. Rather a big one it was. Turning, turning, turning. Whenever anyone passed by, there was the eternal click, click, click of the old monk's prayer wheel. Hour after hour, day after day, he sat there, believing that it was his allotted task in life to keep that prayer wheel turning. And that was all he lived for. We who passed that way so often were immune to the turning of the wheel. We were so accustomed to it that we neither saw the old monk nor heard his wheel a click. I stood there in the dark doorway and pondered as the wheel clicked on, and as the old man softly droned, Om Mani Padme Om, Om Mani Padme Om. His voice was hoarse, and his fingers were twisted and gnarled. I could make him out but dimly, and he was quite oblivious of me, turning the wheel, as often as he had turned the wheel for so many years, turning it long before I was born. How much longer will he turn it, I wondered. But it pointed out to me that people were invisible if we were so familiar with them that we did not notice them. It occurred to me, too, that sounds were silences if one became too accustomed to them. I thought of the times when I had been quite alone in a dark cell, and then, after a time, I would hear the gurgle and rustle of body sounds, the blood surging through the veins and arteries of the body, and then I would hear the steady thud, thud, thud of my heart pumping away. After a time, too, I could actually hear the air sighing through my lungs. And when I moved, the slight creak and snap of muscles pulling bones to a different position. We all have that. We are all noisy contraptions, I thought. And yet, when there are other sounds which attract our attention, we just do not hear those with which we are constantly surrounded and which do not obtrude. I stood on one leg and scratched my head, and then I thought that night was already far advanced. Soon there would come the call to temple service at midnight. So I hesitated no more, but put both feet on the ground, pulled my robe more tightly around me, and moved off up the corridor to the dormitory. As soon as I lay down, I fell asleep. Sleep was not long, my companion. I twisted and turned and creaked and groaned as I lay and thought of life as it was in a lamasery. About me, boys wheezed and muttered in their sleep, the sound of their snores rising and falling on the night air. One boy, who suffered from adenoids, was making a glubble, 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 until in desperation I rose and turned him on his side. I lay on my back, thinking and listening. From somewhere came the monotonous click, click of a prayer wheel, as some monk endlessly twirled it so that his prayers could go winging forth. From afar came the muted clop, clop, as someone rode a horse up the path outside our window. The night dragged on. Time stood still. Life was an eternity of waiting. Waiting, where nothing moved, where all was still, save for the snores, the click of the prayer wheel, and the muffled steps of a horse. I must have dozed. Wearily, I sat up. The floor was hard and unyielding. The cold of the stone was creeping into my bones. Somewhere, a boy muttered that he wanted his mother. Stiffly, I climbed to my feet and moved to the window, carefully avoiding the sleeping bodies around me. The cold was intense, and there was a threat of snow to come. Over the vast Himalayan ranges, the morning was sending forth tendrils of light, colored fingers seeking our valley, waiting to light up yet another day. The spume of snow dust, always flying from the very highest peaks, was illumined now by golden light shining on its underside, while from the top came scintillating rainbow crescents, which wavered and blossomed to the vagaries of the high winds. Across the sky shot vivid beams of light as the sun peeped through the mountain passes and gave a promise of another day soon to be. The stars faded. No longer was the sky a purple vault. It lightened and became the palest blue. The whole of the mountains were limned with gold as the sky grew brighter. Gradually, the blinding orb of the sun climbed above the mountain passes and shone forth in blazing glory into our valley. The cold was intense. Ice crystals fell from the sky and cracked on the roof with a musical tinkle. There was a bitterness, a sharpness in the air that almost froze the marrow in one's bones. What a peculiar climate, I thought. Sometimes too cold to snow, and yet sometimes at midday it would be uncomfortably hot. Then in the twinkling of an eye, a great windstorm would rise up and send all flying before it. Always in the mountains there was snow, deep snow, but on the exposed stretches the winds blew away the snow as fast as it fell. Our country was high and with rarefied air, air so thin and clear that it afforded scant shelter from the ultraviolet, or heat-generating, rays of the sun. In our summer, a monk could swelter miserably in his robes, and then, as a cloud momentarily obscured the sun, the temperature would fall to many degrees below freezing, all in a few minutes. We suffered greatly from windstorms. The great barrier of the Himalayas sometimes held back clouds that formed over India, causing a temperature inversion. Then, howling gales would pour over the mountain lips and storm down into our valley, sweeping all before it. People who wandered abroad during the storms had to wear leather face masks or risk having the skin stripped from them by the rock dust torrenting down, wind-borne from the highest reaches. Travelers caught in the open on the mountain passes would risk being blown away unless they were alert and quick to act. Their tents and other possessions would be blown in the air, whirling ragged and ruined, playthings of the mindless wind. Somewhere below, in the pale morning, a yak bellowed mournfully. As if at the signal, the trumpets blared forth from the roof high above. The conches lowed and throbbed to echo and re-echo and fuse into a medley of sound like some multiple chord played on a mighty organ. About me there were all the myriad sounds of a large community awakening to a new day, to another day of life. A chant from the temple, the neighing of horses, muttered grumbles from sleepy small boys, shivering naked in the intense cold air. And, as a muted undertone, the incessant clicking of the prayer wheels located through the buildings, turned and turned eternally by old, old monks who thought that that was their sole purpose in life. The place was astir. Activity increased from moment to moment. Shaven heads peered hopefully from open windows, wishing for a warmer day. A dark blob, shapeless, formless, wobbled from somewhere above and crossed my line of vision to crash with a sharp crack on the rocks below. "Someone's bowl," I thought. Now he will have to go without breakfast until he can obtain another. Breakfast? Of course. We have started another day. A day when I would need to have my strength up because I was hoping that my beloved guide would be returning this day. And before I could see him, there were morning classes, temple service, but before all, breakfast. Sampa is an unappetizing stuff, but it was all I knew about, except for very rare, very infrequent delicacies from India. So I trudged off down the corridor, following the line of boys and monks wending their way down to the hall where we ate. At the entrance, I hung about a bit, waiting for some of the others to settle down, because I was shaky on my legs, somewhat uncertain in my steps, and when everyone was milling about, it posed a definite threat to my stability. Eventually, I walked in and took my place among the lines of men and boys sitting on the floor. We sat cross-legged, all except me, and I sat with my legs tucked under me. There were lines of us, perhaps 250 of us at one time. As we sat there, monk attendants came and ladled out Sampa, passing along the rows, giving each of us our fair, equitable share. Monks stood at the sides of each row, and then, at a given signal, they all went between our ranks with our food. No one could eat, though, until the attending master gave the signal. At last, each monk and boy had his bowl full of sampa. The attendant stood by at the side. An old lama walked to the lectern. A lectern raised up high above us so that he could look down upon us. He stood there and lifted the top sheet off his book, for our pages, remember, were long things not bound together as in the Western style. This lama lifted off the top sheet and then signaled that he was ready to start. Immediately, the attending master raised his hand and brought it down as a signal for us to start our meal. As we did so, the lector commenced his reading from the sacred books, his voice droning on and on, seeming to echo around the place, and making much of what he said unintelligible. Around the dining hall, the ever-present proctors padded silently, making no sound save for the occasional swish of their robes. In the lamasaries throughout Tibet, it was the fixed custom that a lector should read to us while we ate, because it was considered wrong for a person to eat and think of food. Food was a gross thing, merely necessary to sustain the body so that it could, for a little while, be inhabited by an immortal spirit. So although it was necessary to eat, yet we were not supposed to get pleasure from it. The lector read to us always from sacred books, so that while our bodies had food for the body, our spirit had food for the soul. The senior lamas always ate alone, most times thinking of some sacred text or looking at some sacred object or book. It was a very great offense to talk while eating, and any unlikely wretch caught talking was hauled forth by the proctors and made to lie across the doorway so that when everyone left, they had to step across the recumbent figure, and that brought much shame to the victim. We boys were always the first to finish, but then we had to keep quiet until all the others had finished. Often the lector would go on reading, quite oblivious of the fact that everyone was waiting for him. Often we would be made late for classes, because the lector, getting absorbed in his subject, would forget time and place. At last, the lector finished his page and looked up with some start of surprise, and then half turned to the next page, but instead he put the cover on the book and tied the tapes together. Lifting the book off, he handed it to a monk attendant, who took it, bowed, and removed the book for safekeeping. The attending master then gave the signal for us to dismiss. We went to the side of the hall, where there were leather bags of fine sand, and with a handful of sand we cleaned out our eating bowls, the only utensils we had because, of course, we used our fingers, the oldest utensil of all, and had no use for knives or forks. "Lobsang, Lobsang, go down to the master of paper and get me 3 sheets which can have been spoiled on one side." A young llama stood before me, giving me the order. I muttered grumpily and stumped off down the corridor. This was one of the types of jobs I hated. Because of this particular thing, I would have to get out of the patala and go all the way down to the village of Sho, where I would have to see the master printer and get the paper desired. Paper is very, very expensive in Tibet. It is, of course, absolutely handmade. Paper is treated as a minor religious object because nearly always it was used for sacred knowledge, sacred words. Thus, paper was never abused and never thrown away. If in printing a book, the print was smeared, the paper was not scrapped, but the unspoiled side was available for teaching us boys. There was always a plentiful supply of spoiled paper for such purposes, because we printed from hand-carved wooden blocks, and of course, a block had to be carved in reverse so that it could print the right way about. Thus, in trying out the blocks, there were inevitably many sheets of paper spoiled. I made my way out of the patala, going down by the lower back entrance, where the way was very steep but much shorter, and where there were no steps to tire my legs. Here, by the lower back entrance, we boys would go down, lowering ourselves from bush to bush, or, if we missed our footing, we would skate down on a cloud of dust and wear a great hole in the seat of our robes, a matter which was difficult to explain later. I went down the narrow, narrow path with the overhanging bushes. At a small clearing, I stopped and peered out in the direction of Lhasa, hoping to see a very special saffron robe coming across the turquoise bridge, or possibly, what joy the thought brought, coming along the ring road. But no, there were only the pilgrims, only the stray monks and an ordinary llama or two. So with a sigh and a grunt of disgust, I continued my slithering path downwards. At last, I arrived down by the courts of justice and made my way around to the back to the printing office. Inside, there was an old, old monk. He seemed to be all smeared up with ink, and his thumb and forefingers were absolutely spatulate with handling paper and printing blocks. I went and looked about, for the smell of the paper and the ink always fascinated me. I looked at some of the intricately carved wooden boards which were going to be used for printing new books, and I rather looked forward to the time when I should be able to take a hand at carving, because it was quite a hobby of mine, and we monks were always given opportunities of displaying our skills for the good of the community. "Well, boy, well, what do you want? Quick, and what is it?" The old printer monk was looking at me severely, but I knew him of old. His bark was definitely worse than his bite. In fact, he was rather a nice old man who was merely scared the small boys were going to crumple precious sheets of paper. Quickly, I gave my message to the effect that I wanted 3 sheets of paper. He grunted in reply, turned away and peered, and peered, and peered, and looked as if he could not bear to give away his loved pieces of paper. He looked at each sheet and kept on changing his mind. In the end, I got tired of it and picked up 3 sheets, saying, "Thank you, honorable printer. I have these 3 sheets. They will do." He spun around and looked at me with his mouth wide open, a picture of stupefaction. By that time, I had reached the door, complete with 3 sheets, and when he recovered his wits enough to say anything, I was out of hearing. Carefully, I rolled the 3 sheets so the spoiled surface was outside. Then I tucked it into the front of my robe and made my way up again, pulling myself hand over hand by the hardy bushes. At the clearing, I stopped again. Officially, it would have been to regain my breath, but actually, I sat upon a rock and looked for some time in the direction of Sarah, the wild rose fence. But no, there was just the ordinary traffic, nothing more. Possibly a few more traders than usual, but not the one I desired to see. At last I got to my feet and continued my journey upwards, going again through the little door and searching for the young lama who had sent me. He was in a room by himself, and I saw that he was composing. Silently I held out the 3 sheets to him, and he said, "Oh, you have been a long time. Have you been making the paper?" He took them without a word, and without a word of thanks. So I turned and left him, and made my way up to the classrooms, thinking that I would have to fill the day in some way until my guide returned. End of chapter 8.